It's Wednesday, November the 18th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Joining us today is the crack Irish Times political team of Pat Leahy, Jennifer Bray and Harry McGeehan. Folks, before we start, I want to say well done to you all, as well as to our many contributors and our production team of Declan Conlon, Suzanne Brennan and Jennifer Ryan, and not to mention our indefatigable engineer JJ Vernon, because Inside Politics was named Podcast of the Year at last night's Newsbrand Ireland Journalism Awards. Big group virtual hug, guys.
Congratulations to you, Hugh.
Yeah, well done, Hugh. Well done to the team. Fantastic achievement.
The Irish Times Women's Podcast and the Irish Times Coronavirus Podcast, also nominated, and they deserve a tip of the hat because they're both very good.
Also, normally, like on this morning, we'd all be coming in with stinking hangovers, you know, from the Journalism Awards the night before, trying to hold it together, and we're not. And I just want to say that I'm very disappointed about that.
Yeah, I did have a couple of glasses of wine and we had a WhatsApp virtual round table with my colleagues in the feature department. But it wasn't quite the same thing in that we didn't end up in Keogh's pub in South Ann Street at 1 o'clock.
Having fights outside.
Anyway, just to say, if that wasn't enough to be telling our listeners about, I want to remind them also of our next Inside Politics live event. That's happening tomorrow, Thursday, November the 19th at 7 o'clock in the evening, and with negotiations on the future trade relationship between Britain and the EU reaching their end point over the next few days, I'm going to be joined by our London editor, Dennis Staunton, and by Gideon Rackman, the chief foreign affairs commentator with the Financial Times, and also by Helen Thompson, professor of political economy at Cambridge University, to discuss the UK's future place in the world and what it means for Ireland in particular. And to join us for this live video discussion, just go to IrishTimes.com/Britain Beyond Brexit to book your ticket in advance. The price of admission is €20, or it's just €10 for Irish Times subscribers. So remember, that is IrishTimes.com/Britain Beyond Brexit. Now, it's not exactly all quiet on the domestic front either. We're leading again, Pat, today with the fallout from the Seamus Wolfe story, the Gulfgate, the exchange of public letters with the Chief Justice, the throwing it into the lap of the Oireachtas, and the Oireachtas promptly throwing it back. Where do we stand now? Is the remaining focus purely on the process which led to the appointment of Seamus Wolfe in the first place? Is everything else done and dusted?
I think yesterday was a very important day in this controversy, Hugh, for two reasons. First, we had the clear statement from the government that it is not going to prosecute any further action on it. It is not going to seek to remove Mr. Justice Wolfe by means of an Article 35 motion in the Oireachtas, which I presume means that if an Article 35 motion is put down, and that could yet happen because the People Before Profit solidarity group of TDs have indicated that they may yet do so. But if such a motion is put down, it is clear, I think, that it will be defeated overwhelmingly, and it would be defeated in its initial vote. So what would happen is that a motion would go down and TDs would vote whether to begin a process which would involve setting up a special committee to investigate the issue and so forth. But I think it's clear now that it would not pass that first hurdle. So if an Article 35 motion does go down, it will be voted down. The second reason I think why yesterday was significant is that there was a meeting of the Board of the Judicial Council. And while there wasn't a formal statement issued afterwards, there were reports which are clearly well sourced by Mary Carolyn in our paper and by others, suggesting that the judges will get on with things, the judges will behave as adults. And I think the sort of, you know, cataclysmic potential outcome that was speculated upon in some quarters to the effect that, you know, other judges from the Supreme Court could resign or whatever if the Oireachtas did not take action against Mr. Justice Wolfe. That possibility now seems to have receded. So in a way, I don't think the affair is completely over, but I think we are certainly past an important stage of it yesterday. The bit that remains, I think, and that we may see more of this today in terms of questions in the Dáil, is the questions that surround, or the mystery that surrounds, the process of appointment of Mr. Seamus Wolfe back in Mr. Justice Wolf back in the end of June, start of July, just at the turnover of the last administration and this administration. And Minister for Justice Helen McEntee, who brought the name of Mr. Justice Wolf, or James Wolf as he then was, to cabinet for nomination to the Supreme Court in mid-July, while in the background there was this issue that we've reported on of three judges of the higher courts having expressed an interest in the job but not being selected, which is fine, but the Taoiseach and the Green Party leader Eamon Ryan were not made aware of their appointment. They were simply told, as far as we could piece together, that one name had come through the Judicial Appointments Board, and that was that of Seamus Wolf, and he would be therefore appointed. Now, to anyone looking at this, with reasonably objective eyes, this looks like a piece of pretty sharp practice on the part of Fine Gael, and I think that aspect of the controversy is not yet over and will be probed by opposition politicians. So I think that the danger, if you like, to Mr. Justice Wolf has probably passed, albeit that he will continue to serve an effective suspension from the court without salary until next February. But the political danger to the government remains.
Harry, a week ago, when we went in, with some depth through this subject with Ruan McCormack, Ruan laid out four possible paths that could arise. One was that the Seamus Wolf would resign. Another one was that he would be impeached by the Oireachtas. Another one was that the Oireachtas would take no action, but there would be further consequences within the highest levels of the judiciary, namely resignations, I presumed, of some sort by other judges. And the fourth one was that nothing would happen. And it seems now that the fourth one is definitely the most likely outcome. There seems to have been a successful attempt to lower the temperature in the days that followed the publication of the correspondence between the two judges, both among the political classes and also, as Pat suggests and we report in the newspaper today, among the judges, who are all seem to be saying now, well, you know, we all have to work with people who we don't necessarily get along with that well, but we're all grown ups and we're going to do that.
Yeah, well, it was obvious right from the start that this turkey was never going to fly. But it did take some parties a long time to realise that. And there was blowback, as we reported last week, to the very notion of impeachment from day one. And when you started parsing it, if you stood back a little bit and started parsing the threshold for impeachment, there was no way in a million years that Seamus Wolf was ever going to cross that threshold. And everybody realised that after a while. And the politicians realised it. I think the realisation kind of crept by osmosis across the Liffey to the forecourts. I think ultimately they realised it too. And the focus changed during the week from Seamus Wolf to Frank Clark, and people began to question the basis of the correspondence and some of the pronouncements that he had made in the correspondence, especially that killer paragraph in which he said he had no role in requesting Seamus Wolf to resign or asking him to resign, but he nevertheless went on to deliver his personal opinion that he should resign, which was not part and parcel of his remit by even expressing it, by committing it to paper and then publicising that. That carried all the weight of a Chief Justice, and he was the subject of quite a lot of criticism for that. I thought the government was very slow in terms of acting. I thought it gave too much deference to the message that had come across to it from the forecourts. I think it was slow in contacting the opposition. It was slow in soliciting views from the opposition. It was slow in arriving at a position itself. And then after going through the process of consulting with the opposition on Friday, it went and peremptorily decided on Monday that it wasn't going to proceed with it any further. So it kind of handled it all in a kind of a messy and cack-handed way. And it was no surprise that we had the usual scenes of wailing and gnashing of teeth in the Dáil yesterday afternoon as the opposition parties complained bitterly about the trite way in which the government had handled all of that. So, I agree completely with what Pat has said, I think, and what Ruin's fourth possibility was. It's to do, by doing nothing, they are doing something. Because by doing nothing, they're essentially handing the responsibility back to the judiciary, and the judiciary had to make its mind up as to what further action it could take. And it couldn't really take any further action because constitutionally it's not empowered to deal with internal matters like this, inter se, because there's no judicial council disciplinary tribunal set up, and it won't be set up for another year. So I think the judicial council took a decision that they just let the matter rest. They would allow Seamus Wolfe to serve out his voluntary suspension until February, and then try to deal with it, as Pat said, like adults in a room, and try to come to some arrangement where the judges of the Supreme Court could work together. So what reflected badly on Seamus Wolfe in the initial moments after that explosive correspondence was released last weekend, when people stood back from it, I think the reflection turned on the judiciary. And I think the judiciary have decided that the best thing for them to do at the moment is to cut their losses and to try to continue in as amiable and as amicable a way as possible.
Because the reality is, Jen, isn't it? And I'm surprised perhaps that it took a while for this to dawn on some of the senior members of the judiciary involved in that, is that the wording in the Constitution is deliberately vague, I think, about the standard of misdemeanor or misbehavior which has to be risen to in order for an impeachment to take place. But it generally is pretty broadly accepted that whatever one may think of Seamus Wolfe's behaviour in the Golfgate controversy and his behaviour afterwards, it really doesn't rise to that standard. So this mechanism would have been used to solve a problem for the judiciary rather than for the purpose for which it was intended, which might cause all kinds of, you know, precedents which the judiciary themselves, you know, wouldn't want. So it does make sense that they've just decided to put a lid on this thing.
Yeah, it's that old phrase of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, really, isn't it? And I think that was one of the biggest concerns that the politicians had about this whole, I suppose, process, was that if they did go down the road of an impeachment motion, and if they did establish those processes and those committees, that what they would effectively be doing is setting a precedent, and that this level of misbehaviour, if you want to call it that, would be the accepted precedent in the future. I mean, what one politician said to me over the weekend is that they were worried that they'd set the bar quite low, and so low that in future it would involve the Oireachtas, I suppose, in far more of these types of situations, which is something, as you can see, that they absolutely do not want. But I do think that there is still a little bit of road left in this in terms of the Oireachtas. We know that the Dáil's Committee on Procedures still has to meet. And the purpose, I think, of that meeting will be to get further legal advice. And I think after that meeting takes place, you might see parties like the Sock Dems and Labour come out and perhaps be definitive about whether they believe, and as they've indicated before, whether they believe that there is a role here for the Oireachtas. At the weekend, Catherine Murphy said it was a very open question about whether the Oireachtas should be involved or not. And I suppose the second thing then is, if, you know, as it looks like 95% likely that this entirely moves away from the Oireachtas back to the courts and they do nothing and move on to sit with Justice Wolfe, then this leaves open the question of the, I suppose, the explanations from Helen McEntee about the process that went behind this. And over the weekend, I was working on story on Sunday, and I was chatting to someone in government who was telling me that they were going to, I suppose, reject the demands for her to go into the Dáil and explain, you know, the process behind other judges expressing interest. But one of the reasons they gave me for that was because any such debate in the Dáil could interact or could potentially be harmful towards any other process that the Dáil may undertake, such as an impeachment motion. So if that way is cleared, I suppose, one of the big reasons for not having her coming into the Dáil no longer stands. And I think we'll see more pressure on her in the coming days. I don't think that the opposition are going to let that particular aspect of it go. And if you don't have the, I suppose, the reason or the excuse, whatever way you want to put it, of potentially interacting or harming or putting in danger a impeachment process, then what is your line of defence? It's the separation of powers again. But even then, does that one stack up? So we'll see what way that plays out in the coming days.
Pat, I mean, finally on this subject, strictly one of the people who comes out a bit better than usual out of this particular subject is Shane Ross, because some of his accusations of a jerry-built appointments process, which is going to be misused by the political establishment for its own ends, are kind of borne out from what we see about the process by which Seamus Wolfe was appointed.
Up to a point, Hugh, but only up to a point. I think the my criticism of the Shane Ross bill, apart from its kind of internal messiness when it was before the Dáil, was that in a way it was a solution in search of a problem. You know, of all the difficulties that that the country faces, I'm not sure that, you know, I'm pretty sure that a bad or corrupt or compromised judiciary is not amongst them. And while there are certainly shortcomings in the process for appointing judges, and there are aspects of it which can and should be more transparent, I think it would be hard to argue that it has produced a problematic judiciary. But leaving that aside, I think there's three further points that are worth making that will have a bearing on the remnants of this controversy as it plays out today and later this week. The first is that I think from my conversations with TDs and people in and around Leinster House and government, I don't know what the other guys think, but while it's clear that most TDs, I think, don't believe that whatever Seamus Wolfe may or may not have done is grounds for impeachment, I think that's clear. But at the same time, I think most of them think he should probably have resigned, either because of his attendance in Clifton at the Oireachtas Golfgate dinner, or because of the comments that were subsequently publicised when the transcript of his interview with Mrs. Justice Denham was published, and certainly, and that being borne out further when the text of the letters with the Chief Justice was released this week. So while they don't think that his behaviour amounts to impeachment, I think they would have expected that, you know, it'd be hard to think of judges in the past who wouldn't have resigned for this sort of controversy, even if only to save the court from the difficulties in which it now finds itself. The second point that is that this, you know, idea that this matter can't be discussed in the Dáil, which is, you know, what some people in government are trying to suggest, is simply not borne out by a couple of things. One of them is the very clear statement of the Ceann Comhairle, I think, that while there couldn't be questions about the merits of any particular appointee, meaning in this case Mr. Justice Wolfe, that the process itself is certainly amenable to interrogation by the by TDs, as long as it doesn't traverse into that territory. And the final point is that Micheál Martin himself raised the process by which the former Attorney General, Maura Whelan, was appointed to the Court of Appeal back in 2017, at the turnover of two governments, the previous one led by Enda Kenny and the new one led by Leo Varadkar. And Mr. Martin had some very strong things to say in the Dáil about not the merits of Maura Whelan, though he did, if you go back and look at the transcript, he did make some comments about that. But his real target was the process by which she was appointed. So I think it will be difficult for the government to maintain this position that that this process is not amenable to interrogation by the Oireachtas. And I think we'll see the opposition raise those points today and for the rest of the week.
We'll see how that turns out. But moving on, Harry, I mean, you were talking just there about how the approach to this had been a little bit shambolic and perhaps slow from the government. Something similar seems to have arisen in relation to this social media panic over people slugging pints outside pubs in central Dublin over the course of the weekend at, I suppose, the same moment at which the decline in positive COVID cases, which we've seen over the last month or so, seems to have flattened or maybe even slightly reversed. And a knee-jerk reaction from the government when they decided that they were going to ban this sort of activity without perhaps doing their homework first to see if that was a good idea?
Yeah, they got a bang on the knee and then a Pavlovian reaction, but they ended up kicking themselves in the arse with the way that they kind of handled it. Frank McNally had a great column in the paper this morning about 50 things that have shamed us this year, you know, and he could have added 51 because this was shameful exercise by the government in populism. I mean, it was just really stupid. There was a video that went out at the weekend, the centre of Dublin. And I live near a couple of parks in Dublin. And every night you hear various sounds coming from the parks as teenagers and 20-somethings congregate. And it's terrible and they shouldn't be doing it. But they are, because they are teenagers and they are 20-somethings. And it's impossible to corral everybody in. So what happened was that there was a couple of pubs that were serving pints and takeaway drink. And people started congregating in and around the streets of South inner city Dublin on Saturday night. There were videos that were distributed, but the guards went around. And notably, the guards said afterwards that that nobody was breaching social distancing guidelines when they did their patrols. So what happened was a mountain was made out of a molehill, essentially. And Stephen Donnelly and Micheál Martin came up with this wheeze on Monday, that they were going to ban the sale of drink from pubs. And you have to take into the context for this is everything. I mean, pubs have been absolutely hammered during this pandemic crisis. They've been effectively closed for most of the time. When they've been opened, they have opened only in the most limited of circumstances. And the amount of money that they generate from selling takeaway pints would only be a tiny sliver or fraction of what they would normally make. And it's really just trying to keep their heads above the water. So a measure like this would have been disproportionately punitive on publicans for two reasons. Number one, this wasn't something that was happening all over the country. It was an isolated incident. I think there was one that was similar in Blackrock, the South Dublin suburb, the previous weekend, but it wasn't happening all over the place. So to take a law for the whole country based on a video and based on one isolated incident would have been deeply and inherently unfair. And secondly, the perception was, and this was something that came strongly from rural TDs within Fianna Fáil and also from ministers on the Fine Gael and Green side, is that this was just really going to be unfair to publicans. And that the reaction to it, the kind of the gloomy George Pavlovian reaction to it, was grotesquely disproportionate to what had happened. So they brought this. The Attorney General said you can't really do that. So then they said we're going to introduce fines for anybody who congregates in groups of more than two. We're going to slap an €80 fine on it. But by the time even that got to cabinet, it was quickly withdrawn. And I think they were right. And I just think the government needs to stand back a little bit before arriving at decisions and not be reacting in a venal and Pavlovian fashion to every passing bit of controversy that floats across our airwaves or gets into our newspapers.
I suppose, Jen, some of that Pavlovian reaction, it seems to me, was actually being stoked by senior members of the medical profession who are involved with NPHET. And is it possible that this is part of the first shots being fired in a war over the exit from level 5, which is due to take place in less than 2 weeks' time, if that sticks to schedule? Are we going to see increased tensions and perhaps perceived media manipulation as well, as we had several weeks ago when level 5 was first mooted by Tony Holohan and NPHET?
Yeah, I think there is a certain degree of concern, though not surprise, in government circles at when they hear members of the NPHET or the NPHET, whatever way you want to pronounce it yourself, coming out on the radio and kind of making pronouncements about what should be done, you know, how many contacts a week you should have, what you need to do next, what we need to do in the next 2 weeks, because the fear is that, you know, the last time around that was that Tony Holohan and the NPHET tried to bounce the government into a lockdown, and that this time they're trying to, I suppose, dictate the terms of the exit. And we know, like, that the relationship between the government and between NPHET was reset the last time by their sudden call for a level five that took everybody by surprise and led to a whole week of rancor. And I think this time around, the government will be very keen to avoid a situation whereby it's the public health experts out on the radio and on the television, and it's them on the other side trying to manage both what they're saying and also what they want to do in terms of reopening the economy. And it's a delicate balance, and it's a difficult, I suppose, it's a difficult line to tread, but they'll have to do it. You know, I think that, you know, in terms of the weekend, what you were talking about on the takeaway points and whatnot, I do agree with Harry that it would have been completely disproportionate. And the fact that the memo was pulled tells you everything that you need to know. But they're going to have to really work on those kind of communications and that perception that they're not entirely on top of their response to this. And I think as well, they perhaps showed at the weekend that one thing, they're a little bit too tuned into the public mood, because when people see these videos of people drinking out on streets, and you know they're in week 4 of 6 of a lockdown, everyone's feeling a bit despondent. People may not have seen anybody in weeks and weeks. We're all locked up indoors, etc. And then they see these videos that there is an instant anger, and there's, you know, a lot of, I suppose, bitterness about that. And perhaps the politicians are a little bit too tuned into that, and that's them reacting to that kind of anger and want to be seen to be, you know, doing things and. In order to, I suppose, save the public response to the lockdown as well. So, yeah, I think we'll see over the next two or 3 weeks. Next week in particular, we'll see far more conversation on exiting lockdown. The cabinet will discuss it next Tuesday. I think there'll be a cabinet subcommittee on it as well before that. And they'll go through their response, how they're going to plan this exit from lockdown. And then what one minister said to me yesterday was that the government wants next week to tell people, here is what your December is going to look like. You know, as they put it to me, they were saying, we want to level with people and tell them exactly what to expect. So they'll have to nail down in the next few days whether it's a staggered exit, you know, whether we come out into a level 3 and hopefully move to a level 2, or whether we come out on the other way around. All that still has to be decided.
Yeah, Pat, I mean, yourself and myself and our health editor, Paul Cullen, talked about both the politics and the science of this just before the weekend just passed. I was listening to Catherine Martin, the Minister for Everything That Gets Shut Down, on the radio this morning. And at one point she was talking about this flattening of the numbers, and she said behaviour was very good, but it seemed to change in the fourth week. Now, the fourth week of level 5 was only last week, so the numbers we're seeing now do not pertain to any behaviour last week, because as we know, there's a time lag of 10 to 14 days between people's behaviour and seeing it in terms of tests. You said previously that there are some members of the government who take with a grain of salt the assertions about the necessity for level 5 being introduced at the time it was introduced, and point to the fact that we were already seeing quite a significant reduction as a result of the level 3 measures which had already been in place. Does that suspicion extend to what we are likely to see in terms of proposals from the medical profession for December? In other words, are we likely to see, I suppose, real fireworks between one side and the other on those kind of questions?
Well, there's certainly, Hugh, a dialogue going on at the moment behind closed doors. I mean, Jen has described for us the timetable in terms of next week and what will happen and when decisions will be taken, because as she rightly says, the government wants to have this plan clear in its head by this time next week so it can prepare people for the reopening that is due to take place the following week and for what is to come in December after that. But what that means is that decisions will have to be taken over the next few days on what the pathway to reopening is, and on a basic level, like what businesses are going to be allowed to reopen in at the start of December in less than a fortnight's time. Are we going straight to level 2? Are we going to level 3? Are we going to level 3 plus, you know, which would allow most retail to open, but the pubs and restaurants having to stay closed? And so there's a fair bit of wrangling going on behind closed doors about this at the moment. And the noises that we've been hearing in public from NPHET, I think, are in part at least a reflection of that internal debate and an attempt at the same time to influence its final direction. People in government that I've spoken to are very aware of this, and you know, there was an echo of it in a story that we have on the front page of the paper today, which includes a letter from Danny McCoy, chief executive of IBEC, setting out the position of the business community and pointing out, complaining to Micheál Martin in this letter that was sent yesterday, that about the public comments of NEFID, and interestingly pointing out to Micheál Martin that that he understood, that he, Danny McCoy, and IBEC understood that the government was going to do something about the public comments of NEFID, which obviously hasn't happened. So I think that process is going on at the moment, and we will see. You know, albeit that it is taking place mostly behind closed doors, we will hear some of the noises off stage from that. We will see some of the public outworking of that over the coming days, especially NEFID holds a meeting tomorrow. It briefs the Minister for Health after that. And it also takes place, as you say, against this background of the decline in cases that had been pretty evident since the introduction of the lockdown, and therefore not attributable to the lockdown. That decline in the number of cases seems to have abated somewhat just in recent days, and there is some concern about that in NEFID. I spoke to a person yesterday who would be reasonably familiar with their thinking on this. And I said, look, is this stuff in recent days, is it just part of this dance that's going on vis-a-vis the government about trying to influence the plan for the next stage? And he said kind of yes and no, that is going on, but they are genuinely a bit spooked about these numbers over the last days. And the numbers are the numbers. We can see them over the last 5 days. The decline has abated and crept up. The average, the 5-day average, has crept up a little bit, notwithstanding the fact that the longer averages over 7 and 14 days continue to fall. But that will probably stop over the next few days. So it is a complex picture, but it is a moving picture, and there are deadlines in this. There are deadlines for decisions that will affect December, will affect the reopening, will affect the Christmas that we all have, and those decisions have to be taken in the coming days.
Yeah, it strikes me, Harry, listening to that, that the factor that perhaps isn't taken into account fully by NFET, but maybe should be taken into account at least by the politicians and the government, is that personally, I think what we're seeing here now is people have had enough, and they are bringing their own interpretations of the rules to the table, and those interpretations perhaps are becoming looser as the weeks wear on. I do not believe that people are staying within 5-kilometre limits, for example, which, according to the medical professionals, is one of the key limitations. I think you just need to look at the traffic on the roads to know that that's not the case. Businesses are adjusting. You can see shops with queues of people outside for click and collect. People are adjusting their retail behaviour. And all of that is perfectly understandable. And all those pressures to do more of those kind of things are going to rise as we approach Christmas, aren't they? So the government has to take all those pragmatic realities on board before presuming that just announcing a set of rules and expecting them to be followed is going to happen, because it's not.
Yeah, and there are two phenomena there that you've correctly identified. The one is this notion of fatigue, and it's very apparent. Anyone who goes out will see that the lockdown now is materially different from the one that occurred during March and April, and people are being more cavalier in terms of their behaviour. The second is and it relates to fatigue, is that the question mark over, you know, how many lockdowns can be tolerated before the tension finally gives way and everything snaps apart. We have news today, for example, that Dublin Zoo is in danger of closing permanently because they have no income and they're spending €500,000 per month in terms of just trying to maintain the health and welfare of their animals there. And I mean, you just have to count. I mean, it's going to take a long time to find out how many businesses will not survive this pandemic. Now, when we went into level 5, I was sceptical about that. I'm a little bit less sceptical now, given what's been happening in the rest of Europe. And even though the situation here, I think, is relatively contained, I was just looking at the figures there a second ago from throughout Europe, and our 14-day level, we are, I think, the second lowest at the moment Finland is at 54.7, Ireland is at 114.3. And then you go kind of into multiples of that. Slovenia is nearly 1,000 per fortnight. Austria is over 1,000. They went into a lockdown yesterday. France, 783. United Kingdom, 505. Italy, back up to 800. And the same distressing scenes we saw in Italy last March and April are beginning to reemerge in some pockets there. So we, unfortunately, we probably do need to stay isolated for another short period of time. But people have to be conscious of the hardship that's entailed of it. And I think that people have to also be conscious that when people talk about zero COVID, or those who are advocating a zero COVID situation, you have to think of the implications that that will have for livelihoods and the knock-on effect it will have health-wise, as well as in many other respects for people. And I think the other dimension that needs to be taken into account is that this particular wave of COVID hasn't had the same level of mortality as the earlier one. So we're looking at a level of mortality that would be really akin to what might one expect during a flu season. I think there were about 40 deaths during the flu season as of January in 2020, maybe a little less. I think maybe 30 by January. But I mean, it's not hugely more than that, even though, of course, COVID spreads far more easily than flu. So I think what's needed is some perspective. But also we need to take a wider perspective as well and look at what's happening in the rest of Europe. And if there is a reopening in December in terms of Christmas, I think that we have to ensure that if figures don't improve elsewhere in Europe, that we try to minimise international travel in and out of the country as much as we possibly can. Because that, to me, would seem to be the danger in terms of the virus coming back.
Which might be a tricky thing in its own right. Listen, a brief last thought on this, Jen. You have a piece in today's newspaper, which is about, you got your hands on the minutes of some of the earlier NPHET meetings. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but it seems to me that that article, to illustrate one of the great truths of human life, which is if you want to find out what happened at a meeting, never read the minutes.
I like that. That's good. I'm going to steal that. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was interesting just to see kind of, I suppose, the rough outline of what went down in those meetings. And really and truly, if I were to summarise it, it would be that Tony Holohan came back and he put an entirely different frame on how they discussed the pandemic. You know, he came back in and said, look, we've got to weigh this disease against our three core priorities. And in the discussion we're about to have, keep that in your head, which wasn't what was said in the previous meeting, just a couple of days previous. And, you know, I think he came in and I'm completely like, you know, paraphrasing or whatever, but he seemed to grab the situation by the scruff of the neck. And it really kicked on a debate that they were starting to have about the figures, you know, right into the foreground. And it did strike me as well that in those meetings that week that there was dissent. There were people in the NPHET who wanted to stay with level 3 for a while longer. There were people then who were saying level 4 would be enough. So it wasn't the unanimous kind of view of this team that we should have gone into a level 5. And I thought that was interesting. And like you say, of course, that's not really expanded on in those minutes, but, you know, it is referenced. The other thing I would say, I suppose, is as we come to the end of the year and we'll look back on this year completely dominated by COVID in a political sense and in a health sense, in every sense. But one of the biggest questions that politically will have to be answered is, if you ask yourself, why did we go into two lockdowns? Why has this happened? And the answer is because our health service is not equipped to cope with any large amount of cases. Okay, so that's the reason. So if you get to the end of the year, the big question will be politically, has the Minister for Health, Stephen Donnelly, and the Department of Health and the Department of Taoiseach done enough to increase our capacity in hospitals, particularly in critical care? And I think that'll be a big question that'll have to be answered. And my sense and my feeling from looking at the figures of the number of beds that are available in critical care is that we haven't done even nearly enough. And I think this is one thing that will really, really disappoint people, because people have sacrificed a lot. Businesses have sacrificed a lot. There's just been a huge amount of sacrifice. And you get to the end of the year and it's the job of politicians, it's the job of the government to address the problems and the reasons why we're here. And if they haven't done that, and, you know, we get to December and you have only let's say 300 and whatever critical care beds available. We know if it goes above 350, we're in the red zone. So I think, you know, it'll be worth looking at that at the end of the year, perhaps next month, and asking ourselves the question, did the government do enough?
Right. Well, we shall leave it there. So thanks indeed to Jen, to Pat and to Harry. Thanks to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, and to JJ Vernon on the decks. And if you want to get in touch with us, we're always delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.